and welcome to episode 44 of the University of Registrars Talking About Stuff podcast, in which I have the privilege of talking to Hugh Martin, who's Registrar and Chief Administrative Officer at the British University in Dubai. We review Hugh's career trajectory, which saw him starting out in business, but then moving into a series of university positions in a variety of different roles. One of the most interesting of these was the Chief of Staff role, first at St Andrews and then at LSE. This was new and distinctive in the UK then, but has become much more common, albeit something of a poison chalice role, leading to challenges from all quarters. Looking at Hugh's current home at the British University in Dubai, a small and distinctive institution, which differs from most domestic and private universities in that country, having been established by the government and Britain, including UK universities, we learn how it started with a strong postgrad and research focus, but is now expanding into undergraduate provision, meaning it faces stiff competition from other international universities. Undergraduate recruitment will nevertheless be helped by a planned move to a new campus, which has been a major activity for Hugh. Naturally, we discuss the changes in England's quality assurance regime and the difficulty in explaining in Dubai why the Office for Students and the Quality Assurance Agency were separating, despite QAA's well-respected international brand and reputation, which has been emulated around the world. We also explored how things looked from Dubai and the benefits of the different perspective. Hugh observed that being part of AHUA was really positive, and that he didn't miss GDPR or FOI, but does miss HESA. Finally, Hugh related a great story about the award of an honorary degree by St Andrews University to Bob Dylan for his poetry, and his minimal engagement with the formalities of the ceremony before departing at pace while still wearing his gown. It's a great addition, and I do hope you enjoy it. Well, welcome everyone to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. And this time it's my huge pleasure to introduce Hugh Martin, who is the Registrar and Chief Administrative Officer at the British University in Dubai. So welcome, Hugh. That was a bit of a mouthful, but it's great to have you on the podcast. So it's a bit warmer in Dubai, I'm imagining.
Yeah, just a little bit, yes. And yeah, you're right, it is a mouthful. Apologies, this is the longest job title I think I've ever had. But right at the moment, you know, people out here are starting to say winter is coming. No kind of Game of Thrones reference, simply because the temperatures have dropped from, say, 40 degrees to 38. You know, that's the world we live in. To anyone else, it's still crazy.
Well, I'm sure we'll come on to the particular challenges that the heat might cause you in relation to operations in a moment. But it would be really interesting first to hear about how you ended up there, right? Because it is a very distinctive institution in a non-UK location. But you've had a long and distinguished career before joining the British University in Dubai in other UK universities. So talk us through that.
Yeah, happy to. I sometimes feel a bit of even now I have imposter syndrome, in that I actually started with working in business. You know, I had an English Lit and Language degree, which I nowadays they'll say doesn't bring you anything. Well, in those days it opened anything up to you, and I actually ended up working in my local retailer, and I ended up in business for 6 or 7 years and thought, you know what, I want to give up the suit and tie, not work in an office, and go back to do my master's, and I hope to be an academic. And I tried that, and I was actually a lecturer for 15 years with the Open University, which I'm very proud of. But actually, for some unknown reason, I got suckered back into management, which is what I've been in business. And once I got back into an office and a tie again, I don't know what happened, but that drew me back into that world. And to be honest, I'm not a born academic in the sense that I love teaching, and I still teach if I can, but I'm not the kind that, you know, can be happily doing a Leverhulme somewhere for 2 years just in a library researching. So maybe that's why that path wasn't for me. But anyway, I ended up bit by bit going back into senior management, and that's what brought me via various universities. As you said, majority of my time actually was spent in Scotland at the University of St Andrews, but then at Bristol University, the LSE, and from the LSE to the University of Bedfordshire, which is quite a jump in many, many areas, and then from Bedfordshire out to Dubai.
And
I mean, it is a really, really interesting journey. And you've worked in both, you know, kind of governance roles and kind of chief of staff roles, very close to, you know, vice chancellors and governing bodies. How did those roles feel then? Because, you know, there's a bit of a difference between, it seems to me, between being, you know, kind of registrar, chief administrative officer, where you are, you know, largely at the head of, you know, administration within an institution, or at least a large part of it, and nevertheless having a, you know, kind of senior governance or, you know, close to the vice chancellor role. Did you feel that those kind of prepared you for what you're doing now?
I think so, although I would say the caveat that the British University in Dubai, being an international university, governance is perhaps the one part which is very different here. But look, everything from, say, St. Andrews through to Bedfordshire, with everything in between, as you mentioned, you know, large Russell Group, very wealthy universities like LSE and St. Andrews, down to, you know, widening access participation university like Bedfordshire. It had all been, you know, I was propelled into this with, as you said, the chief of staff role. And that might seem familiar to people now. We see it more in HE, perhaps. But at the time I took that role, it was a brand new role at St. Andrews. The principal and vice chancellor there invented it. He wanted someone to help, you know, corral his senior team, for want of a better term. And although he wasn't American himself, he'd had experience of that. Because at that point, you know, we're talking 1999, 2000, the chief of staff role was really only known in the civil service or the military, and then in America and other parts of the world. But in the UK, certainly, I don't think it was very familiar with for people in HE. And then, you know, after that role at St. Andrews, there was a bit of a gap going to Bristol in a governance role as a maternity cover. But then I found myself in the very similar situation in the LSE, in that the director, as they call their vice chancellor, who is an established American social scientist, very well known in his field, he also wanted a chief of staff. And because I'd done that role before, I don't want to say I was making it up at St. Andrews, but I don't really think many of us really knew what it meant. Whereas Professor Craig Calhoun at LSE knew exactly what he wanted from it. And at that point, I was more prepared for that strategic role that it had become. And you're right, then it prepares you for, you know, by the time I got to Bedfordshire, which was much more of a traditional registrar university secretary role, I was able to see things from a lot of different angles that perhaps the more traditional COO doesn't see or didn't see.
Yeah, and I think it's really fascinating because there are a lot more of those chief of staff roles now, and I think you were blazing a trail. I'm not convinced yet that every university that has appointed one absolutely knows what they want out of it, you know. So there is a bit of copying, I think, going on. You know, that vice chancellor's got one, she's got one, so I want one. You know, there's a bit of that going on inevitably. Yes. Yeah. But I think they create potentially a really interesting dynamic in senior administration, as it were, because you're doing something quite distinct from the registrar, but nevertheless something that's really important in support of the vice chancellor or director or whatever, aren't you?
Yes, and I think you're right on two areas, and it is a controversial role. It's similar to a SPAD, if you like, that there are some vice chancellors that think they need them. They probably don't know what they really need, but it may not be a SPAD or a chief of staff. There are others who, perhaps the way they dealt with things, the vice chancellor I had at Bedfordshire, Bill Rammell at the time, had been a cabinet minister under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, in a very different, untraditional role for a VC, not coming from education. He was used to a cabinet style of government, and he definitely needed that role. But I think others, you're right, probably just think, if he's got one or she's got one, I'd like one. And I have to say, and I'm saying this myself, I'm kind of shooting myself in the foot, but I also think sometimes it's a poison chalice, being a chief of staff, because you are hated and loathed, not just by the academics, but by most of the administrative staff as well, because a lot of whom will think, why have we got another one of these highly paid managerial types?
Yeah, I think there is a risk of of that. I'm sure you know, no one despised you in the role. So Hugh, you're at the British University in Dubai. Tell us a bit about the university for those who aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, happy to. I mean, that's a good point, actually, those are not familiar with it, because it is a very small university even now, and it's not that well known outside of the region, which is not totally surprising in the context of the Middle East, where very few universities outside, say, Saudi Arabia, are even in the world's top 200. So, you know, this is still a very naive young market in that sense. But the British university is unusual because, to be really brief, the United Arab Emirates has basically two types of university. Federal universities, which teach in Arabic, paid for by the government of all the seven Emirates, and mostly Emirati students go there for free. Then everything else is private. So you've got your branch campuses like Birmingham, Middlesex, Heriot-Watt, DMU now, and Wollongong from Australia, and so on and so on. And then there's a third type, and we're about the only one of that, which is we're not for profit, we're not private, we're public, we're actually Dubai government, but we're not federal in the sense that Emirati students can't come here for free. We do charge fees, although we don't make money off them. And we were set up very unusually by the ruler of Dubai almost 20 years ago in kind of cooperation with the British Embassy, the British Council, and one or two others like Rolls-Royce and Atkins Engineering, because he wanted a British-style postgraduate research-only university. Because everything in the UAE is American curriculum. Ironically, in the schools, they're more British curriculum, but when you get to university, they're all the federal universities are American. So then when I came out here, it was actually two of the things that attracted me to come in the first place. They were looking at expanding and moving into undergraduate, which they had no undergrad programs at all, and moving from their kind of rented buildings that we're still in now, but on the brink of moving to our own campus. So we've almost achieved. We've achieved the first aim. We launched our undergraduate programs the year I arrived, and I'm very pleased that I was involved with that. But, you know, to cut a long story short, we've done the hard work first. You know, if you were setting up a university, you would never start with research and postgraduates. You'd start with undergraduate and you build up research capacity. We did it the wrong way around. We did all the kind of research and postgraduate studies, but the problem we now face is we're entering a really crowded market where all the other providers are undergraduate based. There's very little research. And just to give you the kind of final figure on that, although we're tiny, we have about 1,000 students on roll at any time, we are still the biggest provider of PhDs in the Gulf region. Wow. Not just the UAE, in the Gulf. So that shows you how limited the research output is here amongst universities.
Yeah. And is it a very, well, now you've entered the undergraduate market, is it really competitive then?
Absolutely. And so this is really, you know, this is kind of hard stuff now, because we started small, which is great. We started with a handful, about 25 students in our first year. Then, of course, COVID came along and hit all of us, sideswiped us completely. We've started to build up again, and we never wanted to be huge, and we have no intention of going more than, you know, our aim is to be maybe 3,000 students. But still, we're up against some big boys, you know, Middlesex, I've mentioned. Birmingham started out here, wonderful, beautiful new campus, really impressive facilities. And they're used to doing this. You know, this is their bread and butter, especially the likes of Heriot-Watt that have been here a while, or Canadian or Wollongong, Wollongong is the oldest of the private universities here. Wow. We're 20 years, they're about 25 years. So nothing's been here that long, but that's what they do, and they do it well. So for us to have a market proposition, it is tough.
Yeah. And to understand a little bit, so in terms of that student population you're recruiting from, is it, you know, kind of Gulf wide, or is it even broader than that?
Yeah, we are lucky, and I don't want to sound like I'm crowing. It's partly because of the way we were set up. Those other universities I've mentioned primarily are recruiting international students and mostly expats here. So large Indian communities, you know, large Pakistani, Chinese, Brits, Europeans, and so on. For us, we are unusual. We have about a third of our students are Emirati. And we're very proud of that, because for them to do research degrees, we are the obvious pick. But we're also recruiting 30-odd% at undergraduate. And that is unusual, because they can go to their own universities for free.
For free. Yeah. So they want to.
But we teach in English. You see, we teach in English, and we use the British model, which is highly rated. You know, despite whatever you think of the OFS and everything else going on in the UK, overseas, that British model of higher education still has a cachet. And people still trust in that brand, which is, you know, it's something to be both proud of and also almost at times embarrassed about, because of the way things happen back in the home country, if you like.
We might come on to that in a moment. Let me just come back to the point that you made, though, about moving site, because you're saying you're in rented premises at the moment, but you are moving to a new campus. So tell us about that.
I think that would be perhaps the hardest part of the job that I've had out here, of all the things I've done. And I've been involved in big CapEx projects, new medical science building at St. Andrews, fantastic REBA winning library at LSE, all of which were bigger probably spends. And, you know, building here is quite easy. It's a desert after all. But trying to get this negotiation through has taken almost all of the 5 years I've been out here. But we are now, we hope, on the kind of cusp of getting to our own pace. And this is so important. I don't have to tell you, Paul. I mean, the fact for 18-year-olds here is that they are not really making their decisions. It's not like the UK. Parents and families still make the decision about where their kids go to university. And for the mums and dads that come and look at our building, it is just an office space which we're renting.
Yeah.
We would love to have our own facilities. I go and look at Birmingham with envy because they've got this fantastic new campus. I wouldn't lie. It would be attractive. Now, for our postgraduate students, they're not worried because they're coming in and they're all part-time, evenings and weekends. They're seeing their supervisors. They don't really mind the building that they're coming into. But once you're talking about 18-year-olds, and here it's a, you know, it's still quite an immature 18-year-old that comes to university, then, you know, the things that we take for granted, facilities-wise, labs, sport, cafes, that's what they need.
Yeah, yeah. And so when is the move happening then?
Well, it's not yet signed, but the point is... podcast comes out, maybe it will be, but we're very hopeful. We're getting down to some negotiations locally now.
Right.
We do have some benefit being a Dubai government institution that we can wield a little bit of leverage, but I'm just hopeful. I'm very hopeful that this year, finally, having told my staff for so long, you know, because the staff are desperate, the academics and the admin staff are so desperate to get into our own building with our name on the door.
I know. I mean, I can absolutely I relate to that. I mean, certainly when University of Nottingham, Malaysia, opened its doors, you know, 22, 23 years ago. It was in an office block in downtown KL, and it took, you know, 3 years to build our own campus. But that was transformative for the institution, you know, having your own base and then being able to grow and develop it and sell it as something that you owned and nurtured and loved. It made a huge difference, I think, and really helped cement the identity of the institution as well. So I think that's powerful. However, you've come this far already, right? And you've clearly, you know, more than surviving and indeed moving to thrive. So, you know, you must be doing something right. It can't, you know, the premises can't be dragging you back that much.
It's true. I mean, I wouldn't want to say, you know, to the people who moved out from Knowledge Village where they were first sited, which is a smaller kind of set of universities where Middlesex Wollongong are still currently, you know, Bewyd moved out before I came some 10 years ago. Academic city. So we have a little bit more space here. We do have facilities here, other universities around us here. Birmingham's outside my window, DMU just across the way. So this is a better place for sure. And as I said, for our postgraduates, they are very, that they have the brand identity already, because for them, unusually the identity comes from the research excellence, because our academics punch way above their weight simply because of our stress on the fact that they have to be research active, they have to publish with their students. This is a little bit unusual here. It's not at all unusual in the UK or US, but here it is. I think it's simply that undergraduate offering that we just want to be able to say we can speak to the students themselves and they will tell us, you know, we'd love to come and study with you, but where's X, where's Y? And we know, even if we are, you know, putting up the first bit of building, as soon as we've got that land and we've got that contract signed, we can start using that for marketing purposes and the undergraduates will start coming.
Yeah. You mentioned a little bit about the differences in governance arrangements earlier, right? Can you just highlight what those differences are? Because you've got this partnership with government, as you say. So how does that work in practice?
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, one of the things which I like to, all of us here like to try and put right, is that people know that we were set up with three very significant Russell Group universities in the UK. Originally, that was actually Birmingham, Manchester and Edinburgh. It's now Manchester. It's evolved over time to include Cardiff and King's as well. But now it's Manchester, Glasgow and Edinburgh. But they're not part of our governance in the sense that they don't validate us. We are accredited by the Ministry of Education here. We give our own degrees. They are equal research partners, but they were fundamental in the setting up of the British University in terms of statutes, ordinances, regulations and basic, you know, expertise, talking with people like you and others at the time to help this university get itself off the ground, because it really was, you know, a zero sum game at that point. Nothing had happened. But in terms of governance, once now, of course, we have a more mature relationship with our partners, we have some things that you would recognize, Senate, academic board, committees, of course, but we don't have the same kind of university governing body. Our chancellor is a member of the royal family here. He's also the chairman of Emirates Airlines, one of the world's most powerful and important men. And he has a lot of other things on his plate, if I'm honest. He's running, you know, if you're running the world's largest airline, you're not too worried about university apart from graduation, maybe. Yeah. So, and because we're very small, look, I mean, I'm coming from university where I had some 600 staff under me. Now I've got, you know, under 100. It's a different kind of governance game. We can get away with a little bit more here. But we do have quite tight regulation. You know, the Ministry of Education is, we are what's called accredited. So unlike some of the private universities here, we report to the ministry and they do our quality assurance. So we are under a lot more scrutiny than, say, a private university that is not accredited. And it's important that we're accredited, because that's how Emiratis and Gulf nationals particularly need their degrees to be valued. If they're not accredited, they can't use their degree here. It's that simple.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, in terms of regulation, we're not, you know, we're just in a younger market. So I think the ministry here is looking overseas. For example, we've just gone through the British QAA International Quality Review, which we don't need to. We have our own QA, but we've done that almost as an extra layer of QA for ourselves to show that we are operating at a British or European standard.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I was gonna mention that the Quality Assurance Agency issue, because as you observed earlier, we've got these bizarre position in the UK now, where, or in England at least, where the Office for Students, our principal regulator, and the QAA, which is its designated quality body, which conducts quality assurance checks on behalf of the Office for Students, are parting company. The QAA wants to remain an internationally facing body, wants to be part of a European framework, and it can't do that because of the requirements placed on it, or the things it can't do whilst it's delivering what the OFS wants. And the OFS appears, on the face of it, not willing to budge. So you end up with this, quite frankly, surreal position where, you know, the world's most respected academic quality assurance agency is no longer going to be assuring quality in English universities. It is bizarre, and I don't know if it's kind of fully registered with people in the Middle East yet, but I mean, it is going to land, isn't it, at some point?
It is. I mean, I think you're right. Obviously, I would know about this because I follow these things. I've probably even tweeted about it. But yeah, it is a very odd situation, and a slight, I mentioned embarrassment earlier on. You know, there is something about being British out here representing, whether you like it or not. You know, if you did have the Kiwi on, you'd see there was a British flag behind me. That's part of the British university's identity that we have. It's our USP. And then at the very moment when we're being, you know, we're in conversations, dialogue and a review, a proper institutional review with the QAA, I'm also having to explain to Emirati colleagues and friends what's happening back in the UK, where they don't understand the OFS and QAA distinction. And it's frankly weird. And the QAA has been very good with us. We've got a great relationship with them and with the CAA, which is our commission equivalent here in the UAE from the government. But I think it puts the QAA in a very invidious position, because they are busy trying to push this British quality kite mark, if you like, internationally. At the same time, back in the UK, they're going to be relegated to doing other tasks, or just Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and it is an extraordinary position, which somehow must resolve itself, I hope, and maybe a change of government and Secretary of State in education in England may have an impact on that. That remains to be seen. But the way that the QAA over a quarter of a century has established itself as a real international authority, and has it been emulated in lots of other countries as well? You know, people have copied the model because it's seen to be the thing that works and the way to do it is, and we're on the verge of just throwing that away. It is just bonkers and very difficult to explain. I mean, I just can't.
I mean,
we're going to have to explain it in China and Malaysia, and I just don't know how that's going to happen.
I'd be really keen to know and interested to hear your experiences when that happens for you guys at Nottingham, because look here, the QA became preferred partner for the UAE through a lot of difficult negotiations, helped by the British Council, really flying the flag for Britain, whatever you feel about British education, and up against the American quality assurance, which was the opposite and obvious choice really for the Emiratis, because that's what they're more used to. So the fact that QAA was picked as its partner, as its preferred partner, and then all of this shenanigans with the OFS starts, I wouldn't like to be in the QAA's shoes, and I'm also feeling very sorry for them, because the IQR is a little different, of course. The International Quality Review is different from what the QAA used to do for universities in the UK, but still it's a very rigorous procedure. You know, we've gone through a long 6 month review process, including desktop and visit exercises. So this is it's a standard worth having. It's not something you just buy and slap up on the wall. And yet, as you said, now we have conversations with our colleagues who are not based in the UK about, has this really been worth it?
There we go. So we'll see how it plays out, but it does feel an unfortunate position for us to be in. So hopefully it will repair itself. I mean, you're aware of all that, right? Because you pay attention to what's going on in UK higher education. I was going to ask about your how things do look from where you sit, because you know it's very easy for us to get obsessed with in the UK with the kind of minutiae of the challenges we face in higher education here, be that around, I say minutiae, I mean these are really feel like big existential issues around the cost of living crisis, the increase in energy prices. We've got disputes around pensions, around pay, which we know are going to challenge universities in the months and years ahead. But I mean, you look at, when you're overseas, you look at things through a slightly different lens. And how does it feel looking back into the UK in a sector with which you are extraordinarily familiar, of course? So, I mean, it must feel slightly odd, but at the same time, quite reassuring.
Yeah.
Is how I would imagine it.
I think, yes, I see what you mean by the reassuring. I mean, I wouldn't like to sound, especially to my Association of Heads of University Administrators colleagues, I'm very pleased. In fact, that's one thing I would say. How I've been able to keep some of those links has been continued membership of the AHUA, which changed its model to allow international. I think we were the first university of its kind to be able to have that associate membership. But for me, it's bemusement, frustration, and sometimes embarrassment. And I think you're absolutely right in the first thing you said, which is that when you go to work abroad, you have to lose a lot of your preconceptions. Over here, the UAE is very unusual, of course. Only 1 in 10 people are local. All the rest of us are guests here. And you accept that and you understand that, there are, out of the 11 million people here, 8 million of them are Indians. So there's a very different mix anyway. But also you have to put aside all your ideas about what UK education is about and how prevalent it might be and how superior you think it was. Then you get to this weird situation where you're, as you said, outside looking in, and there's lots of things I miss, lots of things I don't miss. I don't miss GDPR. I don't miss freedom of information requests. Weirdly, I do. You're going to laugh now. I miss HESA in that I miss having a regular and useful source of data that actually does something. I miss networking like crazy because there's almost no networking here. And I've tried, and many of us from overseas have tried that, but we have to be a little bit sensitive in this culture about not lobbying, not being seen to lobby, but at the same time, not being able to pick up the phone to a fellow registrar like yourself, or that's what I get from my colleagues back home. But on the embarrassment, or as you said, bemusement, or whatever you want to call it, side, it's when you have to explain, because like it or like it not, you're like, I'm a white middle-aged British guy, I can't hide that, and I'm in a really multicultural environment in a British university where none of my staff are British in the administration, for a start off. But they have lots of ideas about what Britain is. And some of those are, shortbread tin, chocolate box kind of ideas. And some of them are more reasonable. They've done their degrees there. Some of the academic staff did their PhDs in the UK. And there is a genuine sense of disbelief at times of what's been going on recently. First Brexit, of course, and then obviously what happened during COVID, because we've been extremely well treated in the UAE. We've been spoiled, if you like. We've had social distancing. We've adhered to it. We still wear masks. We take temperatures. We do testing every 2 weeks. We had a vaccine. I was vaccinated something like 6 months before my parents, who are in their 80s in the UK. That can't be right. I'm getting political here. But the reality is that I've had friends and colleagues here from all over the world saying, just why did UK get it so wrong? But also, more importantly, why does everyone in the UK we speak to think they did so well? And of course, most of you, in education, I think you realize you didn't. But, there's a bubble in which the UK, especially the government, sits saying, we are brilliant at vaccines. We are brilliant at this. We're brilliant at that. And the rest of us around the world are saying, but you're not. You had the highest death rate. Your vaccines were delayed. We all got two. You had to wait, 3 months to get your second dose. We all got ours in 20 days. The list goes on and on. And it's strange when you look at education, because the way my colleagues at home, in the UK, were having to deal, as you were, Paul, with how do you open halls of residence? What do you do about students coming back? It just seemed like an absolute, I won't use the famous, the obvious cliche, but it looked like a dog's dinner. And here we were, I was back on site in June of the first year of COVID. My staff were all back in June, admittedly 50%. Our students were still online and so were our academic staff. But we were back to normal way quicker, and we just followed the rules. We didn't have anti-vaxxers. We didn't have people saying, I won't wear a mask. I'm not coming back. I am coming back. It's just different. And I think that's been the, as I said, it's been both awkward, frustrating, and sometimes embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the kind of different perspectives that I was imagining that you would get from there. And it's great to hear it, actually. It is refreshing. And it is, I think, a very, very good example of why having you and other international representatives when they do occur as part of the AHUA framework is so important, because that different view is actually incredibly valuable and helpful and indeed refreshing. Just to conclude then, Hugh, I mean, one of the things I'm always interested in, you know, particularly when people have worked in the sector for a long time, is the, you know, it's funny things happen in universities, right? We are strange and weird places. And I just wondered what the oddest or weirdest or strangest thing you'd ever come across or experienced in your time in higher education might actually be.
I mean, some of them, this is an interesting one, because, you know, I bet you've had other registrars with much longer, more interesting anecdotes and longer careers. I mean, I could get, again, more political and say one of the most difficult but interesting things has been the continuation, as I still see, and I wrote about it recently to a lot of them, a lot of critics were not happy, but I still think there is the them and us culture between what we call professional staff and academics, which I thought we had got rid of, but I still see, you know, low levels of bullying amongst academic staff to admin staff, and this anti-managerial thing, which is used as a catch-all to blame certain people on VC salaries and whatever you like, when actually most of my colleagues and professional staff work a damn sight harder than a lot of the academics I know. But putting that aside, because I'd hope that we get beyond that, I mean, the obvious funny ones you see were not always that sweet at the time, like being slow hand clapped into the Senate at the LSE because I was a chief of staff, and this went against their Fabian ideals, and they're, you know, this is champagne socialism at its height, I would say. But anyway, the funniest moment actually is St. Andrews. It has to be, always going to be St. Andrews. And that was when we gave, you know, back in the day, I was responsible for graduations there. And those of you that might know St. Andrews particularly, but any of the ancient universities, they take graduation very seriously. It's like Oxford and Cambridge and Durham. I mean, it's done in Latin, very pomp and ceremony, maces from the medieval times, beautiful. I mean, it's a lovely ceremony. But they also do golf graduations and strange honorary graduands, one of which was Bob Dylan. And Bob Dylan was given an honorary degree for his poetry, which actually I don't think is a bad idea. He got lots and lots of bad press. You can imagine how the Daily Fail and the Daily Hate got into that. But anyway, along comes Bob, and Bob is, I'm not going to say anything about what he may or may not have smoked or indulged in that day, but anyway, he flew in to the local RAF base, which is right next to St. Andrews, and then was able to come, be brought, because obviously he doesn't travel by road very far. And, you know, it's a very elaborate honorary gown they give at St. Andrews, a doctorate. You know, it's very similar to Nottingham, beautiful black little colored buttons and things. And he refused to walk into the academic procession. I could be libeling him now and this would be dreadful, but I don't think he'll be watching or listening to this. He refused to do the academic procession. No way he has time for that. I don't know what else he had to do, but he definitely wasn't going to walk in. So we agreed that he would come in on the side of the stage at the very moment of, he wasn't going to sit with anyone else. He certainly wasn't going to sit through the student graduations. The poor hundreds of students were waiting to see him. No way. And then he was wheeled on. Chancellor Sir Kenneth Dover, the late Sir Kenneth Dover, great man, but really he also probably didn't know where he was that day and certainly wouldn't have known who Bob Dylan was. Bob Dylan comes in. Is given the doff the thing, the laureation is read. I don't think really Bob knew or heard any of it. As I said, he was a little bit out of it. Let's blame jet lag. And then he walks off. Again, doesn't stay on the stage, doesn't take his seat. He walks off. And when I say he walks off, he literally walked off, in that he walked out. Now, normally, of course, like most universities, we would have had a nice lunch with the students, chance for them to meet their honorees, all the rest of it. No, not with Bob. No. Official photographer tries to catch a one moment with him. Principal shakes his hand very quickly, and the next thing we see him getting onto his helicopter in his honorary gown, clutching his, you know, and I don't want to make a, I mean, St. Andrews is rich, let's not be worrying about that, but you know, these things are not cheap, right? These are expensive, and they don't keep them, they give them, not Bob. And he still got it, as far as we know. And we did try for a while to write to his agents to see if he might, you know, if Dr. Bob Dylan at this point would perhaps see it within his gift, either to give a donation to the university, which we would have much preferred, or perhaps return the gown. And they shut off all communication. Very odd. And well, perhaps that's not what you were looking for, Paul. But
Well, no, that's exactly what I was. I was looking. What a terrific yarn. I mean, that's it shows the perils of the honorary degree process, I think, and the challenges one faces. But that's fantastic. But I think you clearly did well at least to get in there. Remarkable that he actually turned up on the right day at the right time, even if he didn't hang around.
exactly. And somewhere in, I don't know what part of America, there is a St. Andrew's honorary Dr. D. Litt gown gathering dust. I said, or maybe it's been given away to who knows, a charity store.
Or maybe he wears it every day. Who knows? Listen, you, it's been great talking to you. Thank you ever so much for taking the time, and all the very best of luck as you move forward to a new campus in Dubai.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. I really appreciate it, and look forward to catching up with you soon.
That's all then from this episode of University Registrars Talking About Stuff. There will be another one along before you know it. And in the meantime, if you can't get enough of this kind of thing, there is an extensive back catalogue of previous conversations with University Registrars talking about lots of different stuff. Until the next time then.